Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation, and welcome to this episode of Talking Up Music Education, our podcast where we talk about music education, celebrate teachers, students, artists, all of us that have been influenced by music education through our lives. And I'm thrilled to have a bit of a celebrity in the podcast booth, Scott Page. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be here. As I was saying, this is my 50th.
And we're going to get into that. 50 years at the NAMM show.
Wow.
The words that go with Scott Page are musician, technologist, entrepreneur, performer. He's recognized saxophonist, guitarist for Pink Floyd, Supertramp, Toto, on and on and on and on. So, and 50 years at the NAMM show.
Yeah, it's been quite a ride, I can actually say. It's funny, I blinked and here we are. And I look back at this ride and it's crazy. Yeah. I can't believe all the things I've done in that 50 years.
So tell us a little bit more about that, being a road musician, a touring musician, a studio musician. How do we start to talk about that? You take us through a few things.
Wow. You know, for me, it was my father. I grew up, my father was a musician. I grew up on a television show called The Lawrence Welk Show.
Who you remember knew? That? Yeah,
yes, my dad.
One, a two. Okay.
That's right, a one, a two, a three. So I was around early days television. So I was always around my father and being around the music business
years. And it's mimicked now on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, it is.
With Fred Armiston. Who plays Lawrence Welk.
Oh, he does. He does
and
do that.
And just to thread that through, Fred Armiston is going to host the Tech Awards tonight here at NAMM.
Oh, I had no idea.
So that's just a little, you know, a little connection.
There
to,
you go.
From your father. And what did he do on the Lawrence Welk?
He was one of the woodwind players.
Oh,
you know, he
my
played
goodness.
14 instruments and he was one of those doublers. He was
right?
a doubler.
Classic and that's doubler.
And that was one of the things he told me. You know, I studied to be an architect. I didn't really want to do music in the early days. I played mainly for him. When I was growing up through school. And then I got lucky and I got in a band with Jeff Beccaro and David Page. We had a kid band called Merciful Soul Band. You know them. They were the founders of Toto.
Yeah.
Jeff Beccaro, one of the greatest drummers of all time. And started playing in that band with them. And I started realizing I was just sitting in an office, you know, drawing all day. And here I was out here getting to play. And there was all these beautiful girls there. And I said, you know what? I think I'm going to be a musician.
there's something about that, right?
Yeah. So I've been, you know, very fortunate. I got different bands and different things. And, you know, one thing leads to another. It's always about, you know, building relationships. You know, I just got lucky. I got crazy lucky. And funny things, I always tell musicians, you know, for me, I'd take any gig. I didn't care if it paid. It didn't matter. As long as I could be around the business all my life. And from that, I got lucky. A few people showed up at the club and I got a call. One day, I was telling the story of Supertramp. Bob Siebenberg, the drummer, used to come into my gig all the time, and I didn't know who he was. He'd sit in the back and he'd drink a beer all the time. One day I asked him, what are you doing? He says, we're cutting this record called Breakfast in America, and we're a band called Supertramp. I said, well, wow. And then a while later, I got a call. So you just never know where it's going to come from.
But you're saying something that I say to young musicians all the time. You have to engage in the industry wherever you want it to be. And there's a lot of really, really great younger performers that, you know, they say they're a jazz fill in the blank, right? Well, I said, well, where are you playing? And who do you know that's asked you to sit in at an 11 o'clock set?
Yep.
You know, you just have to go.
You have to be.
Yeah. And it's also, and then someone on that 11 o'clock set a couple of weeks or months later has to be somewhere else and you end up calling you. And you do 10 sets for them because they had to go out and do a run out. And then you can, you know, some of the lessons aren't talked about, but you're living proof of it.
Oh, no.
Right?
I mean, it's really networking is such a critical part of being a musician, getting people to know who you are, getting going where it's around. My dad always said to me, and he said, well, just play your instrument. You don't have to work in a gas station. You can play your horn. You can do these things. And you got to be around the business. So what I did is once I realized I was not a very good, when I played with that band with Jeff and those guys, I was the second trumpet player at the time, and I was not very good. I was lucky to be there. But I got so motivated by it that I just started practicing and studying like crazy and just mainly make sure that I was around the business as much as I possibly could. So because I was a draftsman and I couldn't play to get a job, I said, what could I do? I became a music copyist. Oh, and, you know, those,
so interesting.
And so those days.
In the days before Finale and all.
Oh, there was no computers. Right. You know,
I remember those days, actually. I did jazz arranging copies. Yeah. I didn't arrange, but I did all the pieces, all the parts.
Yeah, so I used to work a lot for H.B. Barnum. I don't remember H.B. He was like a very, very famous composer, arranger. And I remember getting these calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay, I got a chart, right? Okay, I'd run over to his place, drive over, he'd hand me the chart.
Had really and, precise.
Oh, yeah. You had to write the chart. Right. You know, I was, because of my drafting skills, I was pretty good. So I had a nice looking pen.
And people could read it.
And so they could read it. But, you know, that was also a little stressful, too, because, you know, you're up all night drinking coffee, trying to do this thing. And if you made any mistakes when you're on the session, all of a sudden you got wrong notes, you forgot a flat, a sharp, all that. It was a little painful. But, you know, that really kept me around the business. So I just engulfed myself.
And you're studying?
Business. Well, I was studying trumpet at the time. And then I finally got into, I met a guy by the name of Stan Werth. My dad was actually doing a television show with him at NBC. And Stan was pretty famous. He wrote two claims of fame. He wrote the theme song to Georgia the Jungle and Super Chicken. If you remember that, right?
Right?
So I was lucky enough that he took me under his wing. And he was an incredible musician. And I had to carry all the PA and do all the extra work, but he brought me on the gig. And that really helped me a lot because he was such a great musician. So, you know, finding mentors, I think, for artists is really, really important. I have had a handful of them that really changed my life. And, you know,
well,
it's great.
Was that the crossover to saxophone?
Well, so what happened was, is I did.
That's a big leap.
Okay. So here's what happened. I was playing trumpet and I went and did a gig. I don't remember. There's a band called Delaney and Bonnie. And that was during the days of Leon Russell and all that. And they were very famous at the time. And I went and did a recording session. I was playing trumpet and I met a gentleman by the name of Jerry Jumanville, who was playing saxophone. And we hit it off. I went back to his house and there's nobody that loved the saxophone more than Jerry Jumanville. I sat in that chair and for 3 hours, he played saxophone. Every Fathead, Newman, Lockjaw, Davis, Ben Webster, solo. I mean, just crazy. Next day, I went and got a saxophone and I went to his house every day for 6 months and he taught me to play the saxophone.
Goodness.
And I switched over to playing
and
the saxophone.
Your father played this.
Well, my dad,
part of his double.
Well, my dad's right. Got me started, you know, right. Obviously playing music. He was my obviously right. Biggest mentor in that sense, and especially in business and stuff also. But yeah, Jerome was the guy that really connected with me and really helped me. And unfortunately, he just passed. I want to give him a shout out.
Yes,
just two
absolutely.
Weeks ago. Jerome, you're the man.
Oh, bless him. Absolutely.
And I owe him a lot, actually. He changed my life.
Yeah.
Big time.
I mean, to make the leap from professional trumpet playing over to professional sax, and then it was really the work as a saxophonist is how then a whole nother path opened up.
Right? Yeah. So then I took my dad's advice, you know, to learn to double. Right. Because it was a lot easier being just a saxophone player. A lot of times for these bands that are touring, you know, they may only have 3 or 4 songs that the saxophone plays on, yet they want to. So I took up the guitar. So I doubled
and
on guitar.
And stuff.
So I got into that because that way I knew I would fit in. I could be the rhythm section guy and I could be the solo guy. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me. So that was my thing is I doubled a lot through the years. And that really helped me with the
Did
the
you
gigs.
Pick up flute too?
Oh, yeah. I was a flautist. Yeah. I actually played that before saxophone.
Because a lot of, that's required, especially in the show bands, right?
Yeah. Back in those days, you know. And then I just realized that, you know, I remember I was just telling this story. A friend of mine called me up and says, oh, you got to go listen to this record. He says, yeah, you won't believe it. It's called First Flight. It's this guy named David Sanborn. And I was an alto player at that time. And I remember going to Cower Records that night, getting that record, bringing it home, putting it on. I said, never going to play the alto again. Because I knew that was he's like the Charlie Parker of the alto, because that tone and the sound and the way he phrased. So I just started really jumping into the tenor side. And I realized at that time, I remember laying in bed that night going, okay, how am I going to break into this market, right? How do I get in there? And I remember reading, I said, okay, jazz saxophone players, Charlie Parker, Ben Webster, Ike Quebec, Fathead Newman, Lockjaw Davis, I could name a zillion of them, right? And then I said, okay, what about the rock and roll guys? And I went, King Curtis, Junior Walker, maybe Bobby Keys. And then I said, that's the market. So I changed my whole style and everything and just went full hole into playing rock and roll saxophone. And I'm very thankful because I kind of made a name in that area for myself. And that's how I got hired.
Well, I think if we're, there's a whole nother podcast about that because we're talking about style, right?
Yeah, remember, you got to wear your own clothes. That's the hardest part, right? You start figuring out how do you sound, what makes you unique.
But you jumped from a lot of, right? And then, you know, it's a style, it's a color, it's phrasing, it's technique.
It's all of that.
It's a whole.
You know, so I do things like, you know, I was always trying to say, what could I do that makes me different than everybody else? And I realized when all the jazz players, they're going, ba 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 ba, but they're playing all those notes. And I went, okay, sax, these rock guys go, you know, they're so I just shifted over to that whole thing and really tried to develop a style. You know, I do weird things. Like I take the microphone, like, and I just drop it in the bell of my horn. And people say, well, you can't do that. And I say, you want it to sound like a saxophone. I want it to sound like Scott Page, right? And so I try to do things that are twisted up a little bit to make it, wear your own clothes, be your own sound, right? That's so critical. Just rise above the noise.
You're kind of in, I think we've only been chatting less than 10 minutes. You're kind of giving us this whole, like, this is the 411 about how you need to develop a musical career.
Yeah. Well, see,
first of all, I want to jump in. You got to have chops.
You got to have some chops.
And your chops training started really early.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I mean, I would say
were in the chops game with
I'm going to say a little different. For me, it was more, truthfully, I was never one of those people that had the, you know, there's guys I know, perfect pitch. They can play anything, any key, anytime.
Perfect pitch is overrated. Yeah. You can quote me.
Okay. Good relative pitch is good to have. I wish I had that.
You do. You probably don't.
But know. I really tried to, I really felt that, you know, I thought about the players that really killed me the most. And it's guys like B.B. King. They tear you apart with one note. You know, they're not like monster guitar players, but they have this sense of soul. So I took a more of approach that it's really about that style. And I try to approach the instrument to play melodies. I've changed my whole style. It was David Gilmour that really got me thinking in those terms, because I realized that his solos, everybody can hum them and you can sing them and everybody remembers them.
You can carry them around.
You can carry them around and you hear them. And if you don't play them when you hear the song, it feels like it's you didn't sing the lyrics. So I really focused on trying to become very melodic and playing. But for me, it was not. I don't have a lot of chops. I got to tell you, I'm not one of those guys that can play a lot of,
But there's
facility.
Chops and there's chops. But to be where you are, you have to have chops.
Yeah, different. Yeah. Right. Mine is that soulful thing. Yeah.
I mean, we know there's chops and chops and chops.
Yeah.
Chops and chops.
Yeah.
But you have to have the baseline professional chops to get the gigs.
Oh, big time. Oh, no question.
I'm talking
bass. I see what you're saying.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And when I ask you about doubling, it's interesting because in my life as a flutist, a lot of my short-term students were doublers.
Ah.
And they were, you know, almost all gentlemen, lovely gentlemen, and they would catch a whiff of my sound, which is a classical sound, and they all kind of said, well, what do you do? Because if I could do a little better. So I deconstructed all these embouchures.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, kind of support for really? For the sound. And it was fun because there was, you know, they were so gifted and they had this, you know, all this multitude of abilities and they just wanted to have a little better sound.
Yep. You know? I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, flute especially. I mean, that's a whole nother thing. My dad was a wonderful flute player and doubler. I mean, really, really good. You know, and he could read anything. I remember it was so funny. I got all his music books. I got, you know, drawers and drawers of these books. And I can take any book and open it up and you'll see metronome markings on every one, moving two marks every time, being crossed out, every page of hundreds of books. Right. It just blew my mind that he took
it
that way.
For all of us that bump into this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, music students everywhere, this is... a really great mini tutorial on the basics.
Ooh. Oh, great.
Right? I mean, there's just no, if you want this life in music, you cannot pass by some of these realities because it is, you make this commitment, but then you have to have, you know, the 10,000 hours, 100,000 hours, the commitment to detail. And, you know, the other thing about being a professional musician, you got to be a nice person to work with.
Well, see, that's the thing
You have to bring you have to bring warmth and passion and enthusiasm. Yeah. Care for your fellow. Not everybody has a great day and you walk in a room and, right? It's part of it.
You've said the most important thing at the end of the day. It is about building relationships and being kind to people. And that's funny. We had the pleasure of having a business with Quincy Jones. And Quincy Jones was the most remarkable person because of the way when you talk, I don't care who it was, when he spoke to you, you knew he was 100% attentive on you. I don't care if you're a fan, whatever. When you have a conversation, and I realized that how important that is. And so building those relationships, you know, is so critical. And if I was going to tell anybody, that's, you know, be kind and be nice and treat your fellow musicians properly.
Right. The way you would want to be treated.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about your commitment at this time in your life, which your musicality is, you're still very active.
And very active.
Still
more now, actually, in a lot of ways than I ever have been.
Yeah, but you're with projects and performing and, you know, website, how do they follow you? Just make sure.
Well, all my social media is IAM Scott Page. I am Scott Page. So you can find me on all the different
Just find him so we know where you're playing and you can bump into you and talk to you. Get the nice guy lesson.
Come on.
All right.
I have told him, hit me up on, I'll talk to everybody. Right. So just hit me up on how many of those things.
I mean, when a musician of this established stature offers that, it's sincere and we know that you want to be a network, be a part of a network for people coming up.
Yeah, I love to teach. I love to teach artists. Actually, a big part of my what I do now is I realize there's a lot of people teaching people how to play. My whole thing is how do you make money? I've been a serial entrepreneur and I've launched four companies and there's a whole side of looking at the art of music, but also the art of business. And especially today, I truly believe this is the greatest time in history for the independent artist. I mean, you have this mobile device in the palm of your hand that is a worldwide broadcast network. You can build audience. There's a whole model called the 1,000 true fans. A true fan is somebody who'll spend $100 a year on you. So get 1,000 people to care enough about what you do to give you $100 a year for whatever it is. Come to your gigs, buy your merch, show up, do your online, whatever it is. So the time in history for the artist to really build a living, I think, is finally at a point where you can do it. Now, there's a lot of people that will argue with that. They'll say the music industry's falling apart. Yes, but it's a new business model. So you have to understand and learn the new models.
Right. Yeah. But also part of what you're doing is giving back.
I believe in a whole model called We First, right? It's in a friend of mine, Simon Mainwaring, has a company that's based around that. And it's really about building a model of what you're doing with your business is how do I tie my business into what I can do to help in other areas? So I always teach artists, you know, first thing I ask artists, I say, is it a business or a hobby? If it's a hobby, if it's a business, now you have to start figuring out how to build customers and build a base and to make some money in that. So part of the other thing is like for myself is I always want to have that giving back part because that can be, it's such a good part of the story. It's a win-win. If you create a win-win, that's how you really win. So you always think in those terms. So for us right now, we're working on the building out the Watts Conservatory of Music. And here's one of the reasons right now, 50% of the schools don't even have music in anymore. They're dropping out.
In LA.
In LA. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. LA has started some rebuilds along the way, but all kind of stutter steps. Right.
And people don't realize that music is really who we are, the soul of society. And to see that going away, and you're now seeing so much more of the machines taking over in so many spaces, which is, I'm not against a lot of those.
Technology is here to stay.
It's here to stay, and there's some great ways to use the technology, but it's getting to the point where sometimes anybody can make a record, everybody can do anything. So how do you rise above the noise? So we built a model. So my company, Think Experience, we're an immersive entertainment company because it's very hard to sell music anymore. It's really about the relationship and the experience that you can bring to people for certain kinds of artists. Now, I'm not talking about people that maybe go play in an orchestra or do studio work. That's a little different. But as artists in general, they want to get their music out there. So we built a model for us is it's really a We First model. So everything we do, we get back from our company. So as the money comes in, we put money back into the community. So we're right now along with Flea from the Chili Peppers and Norwood Fish from Fishbone and Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction and a whole bunch of us are working on building a music conservatory in Watts. We've been working out of Markham Middle School, and now we're raising the funds to actually build a space to go do this. And the idea is really to build a repeatable model that we can then scale to take out. So we're building it in Watts now for the first time.
Fantastic.
We're bringing all the music people together. We did our first event here on Thursday night to basically rally the community. I went to all the people and the sponsors and the guy said, "Kai, I want you to come to our show. This year's free, but next year I'm coming to get you to help us build something to make something happen." So I think as a community, we need to, you know, really pull ourselves together to really kind of help this make this happen. And it's great because it creates a camaraderie amongst everybody. And yeah, it's very exciting.
And it brings music education to a community that's otherwise
absolutely
wouldn't have the chance.
Yeah. So, you know, it would be great because, you know, that Markham Middle School, there's a gang on that lives on each corner. I mean, it's the craziest thing down in Watts there. And so to bring the kids in, and we've already seen it by the work we've done with the kids, it's fantastic. They love it. It keeps them off the streets. So that's the idea is we want to give it to the community for free. They can come in and they can, they can play. We've got our music directors in place now. We've got all the pieces coming together. So we're very excited about this.
Yeah. Well, we want to stay close to this as this develops.
Please, so, please. Yeah. We'd love to get NAMM involved with it with us next year.
Yeah. If
we could. So that'd be great. Yeah. So I'm happy to be here to talk to you about that because you're my kind of person.
Well, you're my kind of person. We talk about all these CHOPS things, all these music things. So, so what's next for you? What's in the next couple of months?
On
the road, off the road, in the studio?
Well, again, experiences. We've been doing a very interesting thing. So I'm building these immersive shows and we've been playing now in a 360-degree immersive dome, which is complete. It's almost like a shared virtual VR experience. And we've been doing our first Think experience has been a Think Floyd experience. So we've been doing a Pink Floyd show with a great band, all these great players, you know, Stephen Perkins, who's my partner in this, Kenny Olsen from Kid Rock and Tony Franklin from The Firm. And so we go in and we've been playing these shows in there and it's been sort of my MVP to test the model. And pretty close to sold out 36 shows in a row.
Wow,
and it's going well.
Can we find this all on your social media?
Yeah, you can find it. We've been playing in a place called Wisdom LA. We're planning on now we're building a really big kind of a Cirque du Soleil style show where the phone's involved and it's all tied to a very, I can't really talk about all about it yet online, but it's really fun. So the idea is to create an experience for people because I really believe that's where the market is going now. Yeah. It's all about people are so in their phones all day. They got more media than they can possibly handle. So where is it going?
So I'm going to give you a free idea.
Okay, great.
Think planetariums.
Yeah, think planetariums, right.
Do you know in the post-war, mm-hmm. when they were rebuilding a lot of high schools,
mm-hmm.
there are planetariums in high schools.
Wow.
All over the country.
Wow. Yeah, we know those are the domes, and that's kind of, they were doing those Pink Floyd laser shows in there. Yeah, there's some really interesting things. We're working with a company now that has the most advanced immersive theater in the world. It goes up. You put it up. It's like Cirque du Soleil.
Oh wow!
So we're building a show for that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Watch
cool.
For this.
It's really fun. It's really fun to kind of pioneering new stuff. You know, I've been in tech for years. I've launched multiple tech companies, and so I like the combination of technology and music. But I try to use tech to capture the moment, not create the moment. Right. There's a real difference because it's so easy to be, you know, a victim of overchoice, basically. In today's technology, you can fix everything. I always tell the story about, I think the most dangerous button on the console is the solo button, because what happens is that you can hear what really went down and then you like start fixing it, right? You know, you might cut a track and it sounds fantastic and you get up the next day and you listen, wow, it's good. Let me hear the bass. And you hear the bass, yeah, that bass is a little out of tune. And then they start whittling on it and they forget that moment that everything just happened amongst the players in the room at the time is so critical. So you have to be very careful now and not to mix out all the great stuff, because some of those mistakes are like acts from God helping you out.
I mean, right? You know, there's nothing more precious than a live music experience, even when it's recorded.
Yes, right? Absolutely. I love live. Yeah. I mean, I love to play live. That's my thing.
You know, I think we could go on and on and I would love to, but we thank our listeners for being with us. But Scott Page, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, how much coffee did you have this morning?
I only have a little bit right there, but you know, my mom used to call me Speedy Alka-Seltzer because I'm definitely one of those people that keep going, like the Energizer
Bunny. It's just fantastic.
Buzzy.
Thank you for all that you're doing, all
thank
that you've
you.
Given to the world for music. And all that's next, which is a lot.
Oh yeah, we got a lot of fun things coming up this next year. It's going to be a fun time.
All right, you'll find you at I Am Scott Page.
I Am Scott Page on all the social media.
Okay.
Please hit me up, chat, and I'd love to help artists. If you have any questions, I'm totally up for talking about the business. I teach a thing called SPACE, Story Plan Army Conversion Education. So one of these days we'll talk about that.
Okay, we will. And we thank you so much for being part of this really fun chat with Scott Page.
Thank you.
And thanks for being with us for this episode of Talking Up Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L. NAMM.